Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers, and I'm joined by Gail Schimmel.
Hello, Fiona.
Hi.
Fiona, I'm going to leap in this time, and I'm going to ask you, how has your writing week been?
My writing week has been a little bit tricky because I'm dealing with content that is not completely in my comfort zone, which is a character exploring and finding out their sexuality.
Okay.
And it's something that I sort of waded into feeling fairly confident about. And then I got feedback that I was mishandling this and needed to do it again. And I am doing it again, hopefully in a more thoughtful manner. And I've actually just read a book which has kind of helped me with that. But yeah, it's tricky. I mean, I always have my spidey senses up when I'm writing a character of color or someone from a different cultural background. And I wasn't being sufficiently careful with this issue of sexuality. And I'm going to have to do it in a more thoughtful and sensitive manner. So that's been an interesting lesson.
Very interesting.
And how has your writing week been?
So I made the decision that I need to go back to the book I've been working on. I need to stop farting around, having new ideas, going off on side missions, writing plays, doing whatever. I need to go back to the book I'm working on. And what I have done is I have read through the book. And as I was reading, I made two columns, loving this, not liking this.
Mm.
And when I was in that, you know, when you're rereading your own work, you do read a little bit like a reader.
Yes.
And I was like, I'm loving this. I've got that feeling that a reader gets when they want to keep reading. And then I'd write what I was reading. And then when I was getting not so sure, I'd write what I didn't like, which part wasn't working for me. And I think the most important thing about this is when I got to the end, I decided not to go back and fix. I decided to keep that list there. I will go back to it, but I'm going forward now. And I'm going to write forward knowing that I'll fix those problems, so knowing I can write as if those problems aren't there and the plot turns that I didn't like aren't there. But I need to now get a shitty first draft on the table and stop farting around about it. So that's me.
And how many thousand words are you into this so far?
40,000, give or take, a few thousand. So it's enough of a book that I've done a lot of the hard work. I don't want to abandon it, but it's just not over that. We're not in the downhill part. So it's still a challenge to get there, but I've got enough confidence now that I know where to go.
Okay, well, I'm very much looking forward to hearing more about that in the coming weeks. And in the meantime, what have you been consuming lately?
I feel a bit naughty doing this, Fiona, because normally when we give recommendations, it's the idea is you can follow up the recommendation. And this one will be a bit hard to follow up because I'm watching a series on TV called Killing Eve. And I'm loving it, and it's about to be removed.
Oh, goodness.
And I have to finish all four seasons by – no, I don't even have until the date is removed because we are going away a week before it's removed. So I have to finish all four seasons by the time we go away. So there's this huge pressure to watch it every minute that I can. but I'm loving it. It's about – a serial killer and a woman who starts out at the beginning of season one hunting her, but develops a weird obsession with her. And then we see that relationship and the twists and turns, and I'm towards the end, and now we're getting to what's been going on all along. Listen, I'm not entirely sure it adds up and makes sense. I think it takes twists and turns that are completely incompatible with things that have happened before. But it's with Sandra Oh, who is lovely. It's with Fiona Shaw, who I have a girl crush on. She's just so wonderful. And also another, the serial killer, I should be able to remember her name, but I can't. Another wonderful actress. So it's three strong female characters, and I'm really loving them. I've had a great time watching it.
Okay.
What about you?
Well, I talked about a book that I've been reading that is helping me with the whole exploring sexuality thing. And it is Middlesex by Geoffrey Eugenides. Not a new book by any means. It won the Pulitzer years and years ago. But it's just such an interesting case study in somebody who's both writing from their personal experience and not. So Geoffrey Eugenides is of Greek descent. So that whole story about his family coming over from Smyrna, you know, round about the First World War, coming to America, Detroit, the car industry, that whole background is very much drawn, as I understand it, from his family's history. But the idea of being an intersex person is not. So there he's venturing into unknown territory. And he does it so incredibly well, so sensitively, that I feel as though I personally have come to understand that experience better, as though somebody who went through that experience told me in an incredibly accessible way what it was like. And it's all fiction. All of it is fiction. And it just shows for me the power of fiction in being able to awaken empathy in you and tell you somebody else's story, even if it's not real, in inverted commas.
I read it, I think, when it came out, but it has stayed with me. I loved it. And then couldn't really get into any of his subsequent books. Like, I loved it in a way that everything that came after could only be a disappointment to me.
Right.
Like, obsessively loved it. But I think that thing you say about empathy is really what I'm realizing writing is about and stories are about. That is how empathy grows, and empathy is the thing that we have a shortage of in the world at the moment. So that's very interesting.
Well, a writer who really goes out of her way to awaken our empathy for a very difficult situation in South Africa is our guest today. Our guest today is Marina Auer. Marina is a GP and surgical assistant and the author of the numerically themed thriller novels, Double-Edged, Single-Minded, and most recently, Three Echoes. Single-Minded was shortlisted for the Island Prize. Marina, we're so happy to be chatting to you, even remotely. Hello and welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy to be part of this podcast that I've been listening to for a couple of years now.
Well, Marina, if you've been listening, then you know what's about to happen. And we are going to ask you, what was your writing week like this week?
Considering that the last month has been school holidays, this week has been pretty good. Getting back into routine again with the kids back at school. Yeah, finding my feet. It's a pretty new project, about 20,000 words in. So while my week might be a bit more organized, my writing is still at the chaos stage of trying to figure out who these characters are, where I'm going with this. But yeah, just taking it day by day and making those little small inroads count.
When you talk about it's going well, what is well for you? How much do you write a day? Tell us, give us a little bit of insight into your writing day. And we're going to get into that you are a busy person. You have a day job, and it's a real day job. It's a busy day job. How do you fit the writing in? Tell us about that.
Sure. So I'm happy with about 1,000 words a day. That's a very doable goal for me. And I focus on 1,000 words because I think it works in terms of moving the narrative forward. For me, either getting the story from one place to the next, or getting a character to move from wherever they need to wherever they are to wherever they need to be, 1,000 words seems to be the sweet spot for that. Pushing it beyond 1,000 words a day, my brain starts to go a bit mushy and I start making mistakes and I just start throwing words at the page that don't really count. So I've just learned that 1,000 words is good for me. If I push it to 1,200, fantastic, because then I just feel that the next day I only have to do 800 words. I probably do another 1,000 and sort of just keep on going a little bit above that 1,000 word mark, but then the pressure isn't on. So yeah, happy spot, 1,000 words a day. And I just try and squeeze it into whatever time I have. My day job is very variable, very unpredictable at times, because when I think that I might have a morning to sit and write, often I get a phone call to say, emergency Caesar, in half an hour, can you be here? And so I down writing tools and pick up surgical tools and swap hats. So I just have to make use of the couple of hours that I have here and there. Mornings are my best, but if I have to try and get an afternoon session in, then I will. And some days it's just not possible. Some days I just have to say, okay, today was not a writing day. 1,000 words a day, if I get 5,000 words done in a week, I'm happy. So that does give me a couple of days to play with. And, you know, 5,000 words a week is enough to have a complete manuscript, a first draft at least, in 4 months. So those little chunks, just that daily deliberate action of getting a bit of work done really counts in the long run. So here I am sitting at sort of 20,000 words in this manuscript, and it's quite overwhelming to think of the journey that we still got to go on with these characters. But I can't focus on that. I can only focus on taking it that next little step and that next little step. And it's amazing how sometimes you just do that and then you look up and wow, you're at that dreaded 30,000 word mark. And then you think, oh, okay, slog it out, slog it past the 30,000 word mark, and then you're at 50,000. And then, you know, you start the easier downhill road. So yeah, a little bit a day, daily deliberate action, not putting too much pressure on myself, and just being, just making it fit, making everything fit into the whole that a mother and a wife and a doctor and a writer has to juggle in a day.
I see you've said that you originally planned 4 novels inside this fictional world, not a series exactly, but they all take part in the same fictional world. So is this the 4th one that you're working on now, or is that one already finished?
Yeah, that one's already finished. I feel a little bit embarrassed when I say this because people say, oh, you're so prolific. But really what it is that I started writing in 2019 and I wrote Double Edged in 2020. And then Double Edged only got published in 2023. So I'm a little bit ahead of the curve. If you keep on writing, traditional publishing takes so long that it's quite easy to get ahead of schedule. So the 4th novel is written. Locked and loaded. I'm still awaiting that dreaded editorial letter to see what I've got to tweak and what I've got to change. But it should be published probably in the early half of 2026. And so that's done and dusted, and then that world for me is complete. I do have a few ideas maybe of picking up again, but I have a bunch of manuscripts that are different characters, not lead female doctor main characters, that I've got in the bag that I'd also like to see the light of day. So yeah, we're just going to take it one step at a time at this point. And but yes, number four is done, thank goodness.
I want to go back to, you said you started writing in 2019, so obviously you've started your life in a very scientific person. You studied medicine, you work as a doctor, you work as a surgeon. Did little Marina want to write? Like, where did the writing ambition start? And what made you decide eventually, actually, I am going to try and do this?
I can't say that I always dreamt of being a writer. But I suppose back in those days when you're a child and you have that magical thinking, I did have the idea, along with when I'm an astronaut or when I'm president of the United States or when I'm an archaeologist, I did have that thought, when I'm a writer, I would like to write books like Agatha Christie. Although the idea of Barbara Cartland spread out on her chaise lounge dictating her novels to a secretary while she was dipping in diamonds also appealed. But yeah, the idea of being an Agatha Christie and putting together those kind of mysteries certainly appealed. But as you said, I knew from probably senior primary that I wanted to become a doctor. And so my entire high school career was aimed at that. I did what I needed to do to get into med school. I did what I needed to do to get the marks and to tick off all of those boxes that you need to tick off to get into a medical degree. And so it was a very scientific path that I followed. Then for the next decade, I suppose, you know, med school is a long process, and then it's internship and community service, and then after community service I did start specializing for a while, and then I got married and I had kids, and all of that takes over and becomes the focus. And it was really only when my kids were getting to the stage where they didn't need me as much. 2019, I would have had a 9-year-old and a 10-year-old, so they didn't need me quite as much. And this idea for a book, well, let's go back a step. So my husband and I met at a hospital called Edendale in Pietermaritzburg, quite a chaotic hospital. Actually, the place that the hospital in Single Minded is based on. And for years, we said to each other, someone needs to write a story, write a book about what happened in those years. I mean, just crazy, crazy stories and events, only a fraction of which are represented in Single Minded. And after a while, my husband, instead of saying, someone needs to write this book, he started saying, well, you need to write this book. And I don't know what he based that confidence in my writing abilities on. Perhaps just the fact that I had written pretty decent letters home when I was when I was working overseas, or I actually had a baking blog going at one stage. Maybe it was the fact that when we sit and watch a series together, I always know what I always know who the killer's going to be. I always know what the next step's going to be. So he had this unfounded confidence in my writing abilities. And he kept on saying, well, you need to write that book. So I did have a few ideas in mind of books that I could write. And yeah, that day in 2019 came along where I was like, you know, sometimes I overthink things and sometimes I just, okay, it's time now to jump in. And I'm like that with manuscripts as well. And I just sat down at the computer. I didn't even have a laptop. I sat down at a desktop computer and I just started typing. And the story that came out of me then was not great. But what I learned in the process of writing it was that I could start on page one and get to page 300 and write a complete manuscript. And I didn't need to know everything beforehand, because that's what had put me off. I knew that I could probably start a story, but I didn't know how to end it. And that was intimidating. But just doing that, starting writing and getting words on the page, was so revealing to me that actually it's doable. And when I'd finished that, I realized that actually I needed to go back and write something that I was more familiar with. And that's how Double Edged was born, because it was a book that is set very much in the world in which I live now. I wasn't ready to write the single-minded story yet, because that felt like a memoir, and I'm not keen on memoir. I wanted to write thrillers, and with Double Edged, I could dive into that world. But once Double Edged was finished, I felt more confident to visit what I had in mind for single-minded, and yeah, that's how it started.
You've described yourself as not a plotter, and you've said previously and you've said again now that realizing that you don't have to have the whole book worked out in advance gave you the freedom to actually start. But on the other hand, you write these very tightly plotted thriller novels, and I want to know how you do that without plotting in advance. You know, does it end up that you have to sort of go back and correct stuff that went a bit off kilter? Have you changed the way you do it? How do you write your kinds of novels without plotting in advance?
Yeah, that's I don't always know how to answer that, because I actually don't know how the magic happens. I can't walk from the lounge to the kitchen and remember why I've gone to the kitchen. So I don't know how it's possible that I keep track of all of these various threads that I have in my novels. But somehow when it's on the page, it's real enough for me to follow and to build these various threads in together. But no, it doesn't happen in the first draft. The first draft is messy, and I give myself permission to let the first draft be as messy as it needs to be. When I write those 1,000 words, and I don't go back the next day and edit that and try and fix it, because I do feel that writing and editing are two different processes. I feel that different parts of my brain are engaged in those, and so I don't cross those over. So what goes onto the page stays on the page unless something radically needs to change, and then I'll come back and I'll change that before I get to the end of that draft. But for the most part, a first draft is written continuously without changing too much along the way. And if I've threaded something in, if an idea comes to me, well, I need to have this kind of character or this kind of event, then I go with that flow because I do feel that my subconscious is working constantly and I let that have free rein. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. You know, I have had to go back in a second draft and eliminate a character entirely because they had no purpose in the story. But that doesn't happen too often. For the most part, when those kind of characters are seeded that I wasn't anticipating, or a scenario was seeded that I wasn't anticipating, I tend to work those into the story because it makes it more interesting, it gives it more depth, and I love those kind of discoveries. To me, it's like I am going on this adventure along with the reader. If I get to two-thirds through the book and it only dawns on me who the villain is, that's like, wow, okay, I didn't know that, so I suppose my reader isn't going to know that either. That to me will then be a good twist. I never start with a twist and then work my way back from that because I think that's too contrived. So I do try and have these all sorts of ideas coming to me at once, and it's a bit of chaos in the first third of the book to get them down and to try and make sense of them, but yeah, letting that process happen and going with the flow, and then second draft, third draft. I love the editing process. I think sometimes that I write just to make sense of things in the edit. And I look forward to that. So, yeah, I write messy in the first draft and then come and fix that up. Enjoy the challenge of fixing it up in the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth draft, whatever it takes to get it to what I need it to be.
I'm very interested. I believe that you got a 3-book deal for these 3 books. Is that correct? And can you tell us a little bit about your road to publication and how it's very unusual to get a 3-book deal in South Africa? So how that came about?
So I had written Double-Edged and put it out into the world. I knew nothing about publishing. I mean, the manuscript that I submitted to various publishers and to agents was so raw. I'm embarrassed about it now. You know, the font, the formatting, everything was just not what it should be. But in my great enthusiasm, I put it out into the world. And I had been given some advice that you don't want to publish in South Africa. You know, the market is tiny. You'd rather get it published overseas. So I had approached agents in the UK and the US. And obviously was getting rejection after rejection after rejection. So I just kept on writing, and I was busy with Single Minded when I finally got a response from Quella. I'd actually already submitted to NB, I'd submitted to Tafelberg, not knowing what the various imprints did, not knowing that Tafelberg would concentrate on Afrikaans. I had just put it out there into the world. But then I had been getting all the rejections, so I thought, okay, well, let me try again, let me get back to the drawing board. And I had seen Quella as an imprint of NB, so I had submitted to Quella. Kept on writing, getting busy with Single Minded, and thinking, okay, well, if it's not going to be Double-Edged, then maybe Single Minded will be the one that I will get out into the world or get an agent or publishing deal for. So I had pretty much finished Single Minded when I heard back from Quella, and they said they're interested, but I would have to change this and I'd have to tweak this. And, you know, we would see. It was a hesitant okay, which was much better than all of the no's that I'd got so far. So I ran with it. And I did, when I got the editorial letter back, I thought, this is not something that I'm ever going to manage to fix. Let's just throw this manuscript in the bin, forget about it. It was just overwhelming for me as a real novelist to have to deal with the changes that I needed to make. And I really didn't think that I could do it. But like everything, I just get into solution mode and take it one step at a time. So I did those changes and I sent it back to Quella and got the okay. Yeah, we're going to publish this. And Double-Edged was not out in the world for a very long time. I'm trying to think of the timing now. My memory is as bad as yours is, Gail. But I don't know. We didn't even know, you know, how Double-Edged found itself out there and what the sales were like before Stevlin came back to me and said, okay, we're going to take your next 3 novels. But by that stage, by the time Double-Edged was published, I'd actually completed another three. So I had Single Minded, what's now Three Echoes, and then the fourth novel. They were done. Maybe not perfectly done, but they were done. And I don't know if I would have taken a three-book deal if I hadn't had all three in some kind of rough format, because I just know that, yeah, I can work under pressure, but the pressure to be creative with the deadline probably would have killed my creativity. So I accepted the three-book deal gladly, but yeah, I think I would have been hesitant to say, yeah, take three books if I hadn't written all three of the next manuscripts. So yeah, it was amazing, but I'm always focused on the next step, the next step. So that seemed to me like a logical next step. I had completed three manuscripts and Quella wanted them, and fantastic, okay, let's get them done. So one step at a time, and yeah, you keep on working, and then things work out.
You've talked about the dreaded editorial letter arriving in your inbox. How are you as an author being edited by an editor? You know, I feel like as women, a lot of us are people pleasers, and we immediately go into, you know, I can fix this, I can make it right. Or do you push back a bit? What are you like as that author?
And I want to add to this, especially given that you know the medical stuff better than any editor is going to know. You know, you kind of are the expert editor in this.
Yeah. So let's just deal with the medical side first. I take that very seriously, because that's the one thing I don't want to get wrong. I mean, you're always going to get things wrong. You try your best. You try your best to get the perfect manuscript out there, but there's always going to be a couple of issues that fall through the cracks, right? So we have to live with that, as hard as it is. But the medical stuff, I know that's on my shoulders. No one is going to question my description of tendons in the hand, for example. And that one comes to mind because in Double Edge, there's a scene where tendons in a hand get sliced through. And the time I spent making sure that I had those tendons described absolutely correctly, ridiculous time spent doing that, when maybe one hand surgeon would read the book ever and question my anatomy there. Ridiculous. But I do feel like I need to get it right, because that's on my shoulders.
I have to ask, are there a whole lot of patients who came in for a Caesar and ended up with their hands chopped off so that you could experience what their tendons looked like?
Thankfully for Google, and we have anatomy atlases, and yeah, thankfully the research is just at the tip of our fingers these days, so I could check and recheck my knowledge. Where were we? Oh yes, that first editorial letter. So what was very reassuring to me when those suggestions came from the outside reader at that Quella had used for Double Edged was that I knew that there were weak points in that manuscript, and those were exactly what were highlighted in that letter. So I knew that we were on the right track. I didn't necessarily know how to fix them, but I knew that we were on the right track. And I've been very grateful that subsequently, we don't have the same external reader for every manuscript. I've had the same editor for every manuscript, which is great. So we know how to work with each other now. But the external readers that we've had are just seem to pinpoint the things that I agree with. If there have been issues that I see that perhaps they haven't read me correctly, or they've seen a situation from a different perspective that is not what I meant, then I'll disagree with them, but I will re-look at the work and think, okay, if they're an expert reader, right? If they've seen it that way, then I need to make sure that my readers aren't also going to misread the situation. So I'll tweak it. But there are times, I don't push back hugely, but there are times where I can justify, okay, no, I'm saying it like this because I feel like I might have a bigger perspective. I'm saying it like this here because of this scenario here. And then, okay, that's the reason why. But I'm not, I'm certainly no diva. And I am a people pleaser. And so when I'm in editing mode, I'm like, okay, you're the expert. I'm not. And listen to that advice, because it's good advice for the most part.
I was interested, you both, Marina, you and you, Fiona, have used the word thriller to describe your books. I want to know if that is the genre you feel you fit into most comfortably, because I've also seen some other descriptions of your books, so medical suspense, suspense. I think I've seen horror bandied about a bit as well. So where do you feel you sit most comfortably?
The distinction between thriller and suspense can be academic, but it's definitely there, right? And so Double Edged would fit very much into the thriller genre. It's a cat and mouse chase. Single Minded is perhaps a more medical, is more mystery suspense with, and that's where you've heard the gothic horror element with elements. Gothic horror in Single Minded. And then Three Echoes, I'd say once again, is probably more suspense than thriller. But the distinctions really, I do like to sort of cross over as well. It might not be purely 100% of any of those, but definitely suspense, thriller with medical elements. Not necessarily always a medical thriller, but a thriller with medical elements is my happy place to write, and also my happy place to have my novels described.
And I read somewhere that you would like to write horror, that you're attracted to horror as a genre. Talk to us about that.
I think it comes from growing up and reading Stephen King, who was, if I ever had an author that would be a definite purchase in my youth, it was Stephen King. Not so much now.
I still do.
Yeah.
I still do.
Do you?
Yeah.
His latest ones to me aren't hitting the mark as much as they used to, but I just love creepy crawly stuff. And that's why I introduce it into my work as often as I can, but it's not always appropriate. And I've also lost that ability to just be fantastical, I think. If I'd been writing when I was younger, I might have explored fantasy, science fiction, because I love those genres as well. But part of me is so scientifically minded now. So my feet are so firmly concreted into reality that I can't really just let loose and explore the paranormal. I'll introduce the suggestion of it into my novels, but the solution, the actual answer, is probably not going to be paranormal. It's going to be something that makes logical sense, right? But yeah, I still love the horror genre.
Marina, I've been following you on Instagram for a while now, and I've noticed that you use social media very effectively to set up a relationship between yourself and your readers, to engage them and get them sort of involved in the process. How did you learn how to do that? And what would be your best advice for authors who want to leverage social media in this way?
Oh, social media. I have to admit that I don't love it. It's a bit of a love-hate relationship, because I think it is necessary these days to have a presence. A part of me feels like I'd like to be that person that just never got onto social media and didn't have to now continue with it. But it is where we are, right? So you have to embrace it. I always feel more comfortable when I've got a book to promote, because then it feels like proper content. I don't like just having to make up things and pretend to be a person that I'm not. So it has to be authentic for me, which is hard, and you don't always have content to share. But my cats help in that regard. I picked an odd picture of a cat lying on my lap while I'm trying to write. Thank goodness for that. Maybe I learned a little bit about social media and getting people engaged when I was writing my baking blog. And I actually, for a while, they're changing hats now. For a while there, I ran cupcake and biscuit decorating classes. So that's another character I assumed for a while. And that was easy, because you've always got pretty pictures of things people want to eat to put up. But that was my first foray into social media, because before that, I wasn't a presence on social media. And I think the point is to just keep it up quite regularly, almost like the writing. I can't post every day. I don't have the time for it. I don't have the energy for it. But when something's happening, or there's a new book coming out, or there's a book fair, just to use those opportunities, just to use those photos and make the most of what you've got to put out there to the world. I but I wouldn't say I'm an expert, and I'm kind of figuring it out as I go along. And as the most I can probably do is Instagram, which then feeds directly to Facebook. I'm not great about responding to comments. And TikTok, I'm not even willing to go there because it's just too uncomfortable for me. It's just a world that I just – and I know my teenage daughter would be cringe, Mom, like cringe. Don't. Please, Mom, don't. So for now, I'm not even thinking about TikTok. Well, no. That's a lie. You always think about TikTok as a writer, don't you? Because of the power of BookTok. But I can't bring myself. I can't bring myself to get there. But my advice to authors probably would be get onto BookTok. I mean, it's so powerful. So that would be my advice. Do what I say, not what I do. And then just try and keep it real on social media, on Instagram. For me, that's what I respond to best. Is when I can see there's a genuine person behind the posts. That's what appeals.
I have to tell you, you've made the right decision about TikTok with teenagers, because I was doing it because I felt that pressure. And it actually became a thing that became a problem for my teenagers, that their friends were following me on TikTok and they didn't like it, and it actually turned a bit ugly. So I've stopped doing TikTok, and I'm going to wait till they're grown up before I go back. It was a strange space. My one teenager will not forgive me if I do not ask a question about jiu-jitsu, because I have a jiu-jitsu teenager. And I believe that you are a proper jiu-jitsu person. I'm interested in that, because it doesn't seem like a very writerly occupation. And also I'm interested because to me it looks too terrible, because you've got to touch sweaty strangers, which I can think of nothing worse. I'm interested in that aspect of your personality, how it fits in with the rest, and also if it has informed your writing in any way.
Sure. Once again, that's an example of I'm actually a very measured person. I do think about things. I'm not a friend of chaos, even though I write chaos on the page. But when it came to jiu-jitsu, I knew that I wanted to do a martial art, not judo or karate that all the kids do in the area. And an opportunity to join a jiu-jitsu class came up. We don't have too much where we stay, and jiu-jitsu was new to the area. And without doing any research, I signed up for it. I honestly thought that it would be kind of a kickboxing taekwondo scenario. I did not know that jiu-jitsu was wrestling. How ridiculous is that? I did not know that jiu-jitsu is pretty much based on the floor, on your back, or sitting on someone else's chest and grappling.
Sweaty.
So that was a rude awakening. Sweaty. You wouldn't believe how sweaty. You wouldn't believe how sweaty. But that kind of adrenaline is quite addictive, and that ability to hold your own in a scenario like that is very empowering. So I didn't do it for, I mean, I did it for a few years, and I didn't do it, I would say, with any kind of professionalism, because it was squeezed into my day as everything else is. And I did, I competed once in that infamous cage fight, which I'd rather forget, but I never did any grading or anything like that. But those skills, as I've said before, I think it's really important for a woman to know how a little bit about self-defense. And I also learned in the process not to be afraid of pain. So many people, when they hurt, will withdraw, will cower back. And I think for a woman, it's really good to know that it's not, pain is not a reason to cower. Pain is maybe a reason to stand up and fight for yourself. So that was great for me. And I love writing fight scenes, maybe because of that, because I have a little bit of confidence in the body's ability to fight back. So give me a fight scene where a woman is getting the upper hand, and I am, and I'm thrilled.
Let's talk a bit about writing about cultural issues that are different to one's own background. Now, in Three Echoes, you go into this world of spiritual beliefs that are different to your own. You talk about beliefs in the Tokoloshe and issues like that. What sort of research went into that? How comfortable did you feel writing about these cultural issues that are not your own? And did you get any pushback along the way?
So if you've read Three Echoes, I think you'll realize that I speak about those cultural issues, Sangoma's, but it's maybe not diving into the Sangoma's world, because without revealing anything, it's not really what you think when you go into it. But I certainly did feel that I had to be very cautious about that and to not step on any toes. But because the book is written from a doctor's perspective, and that doctor has the same perspective that I do, skepticism when it comes to traditional practices. When you've worked in medicine in South Africa, you've seen the negative effects of a system that runs parallel to Western medicine, which can be at best help someone, because psychologically we all know that you have to have a treatment regime which you believe in. So certainly traditional medicine does help people, but at worst it can have very damaging effects as well. But then so can medicine, you know, so can Western medicine. You can do an operation and someone can have terrible complications from that. But just treating that with respect and not trying to present it for anything other than what it is, and that the main character in Three Echoes, we see it through her eyes and her perspective. And that is, to me, that's enough. That, look, I'm not writing a book about traditional medicine. I'm not writing a book about Sangomas. I'm writing a book where a character encounters those ideas. So that reassured me a little bit that it wasn't going to upset too many people. And then in Single Minded, the idea of the Tokolosh coming in, we grew up with the Tokolosh. We grew up with stories of the Tokolosh. So those stories feel very much a part of my own childhood. And they were presented through then that main character's eyes, Murphy's eyes. And once again, the story isn't about the Tokolosh, it's about the idea of the Tokolosh. So I'm always careful to sort of introduce them, but not pretend to be the expert in that matter. And I hope that comes across. It's just an idea. It's just what we live with in this country. It's always there, but we're not necessarily going to make it the entire focus of the book. Because I can't. I can't presume to be the expert in those matters.
You've touched on what I want to ask you about next, which is your main characters are female doctors. You are a female doctor. The inevitable question, and I think every writer's asked this, but you must be asked more than other people, how much of you, how much is imagined, and how do you actually keep it separate and then create different female doctors each book that are their own characters without making them just you one, you two, you three, you four?
Yeah. Great question. So with my first book, Double Edged, I really didn't want people to think that the main character, Erin Taylor, is me. So I physically made her different to me. She's blonde and blue-eyed and, how different can we make it? But I didn't want people to think that I was writing about me. I still got questions, though, from people. Did you really get abducted and put into the boot of a car? No, I didn't really get abducted and put into the boot of a car. It's a fictional character. So, of course, there's a bit of me in everyone that I write, because how can there not be? But I try not to take one element and explore that. But I do try and make sure that every female doctor, and they do, they have a different specialty that they're in. They're in different marriage circumstances, or they're single or married, or whatever the scenario is, kids, no kids. and they're in a different specialty. So that leads them down a different road, and also different backstories, different problems that they're dealing with. So that naturally leads them into being completely different characters. Murphy in Single-Minded is a different point in her career. She's a junior doctor still, so I tapped into all of those insecurities that I felt when I was a junior doctor. Erin is the surgeon, the accomplished surgeon. She's far more confident. And as I've said before, I think that I was channeling then the confidence that I felt writing this first manuscript that really was gelling for me. Whereas when I was writing Single-Minded, I was getting all the rejections from the agents and publishers that were out there. And so Murphy is a bundle of insecurities that was channeling my insecurities then. And then Sarah in Three Echoes is just a little bit more, she's probably the least like me, a little bit impulsive and impetuous, but she was just a really good fit for that particular story.
And the other characters, how often do you have people coming up to you and going, oh, I recognize my case there, or I recognize myself there? Are you having a problem with patients thinking they're going to be written into a book?
It's more my colleagues. So in Double Edged, there is a character who was so interesting in real life that I pretty much put him as is into the pages of the book. And everyone that read Double Edge said, oh, we know who that is. And of course, I would never confirm it. And I think the man himself is a little bit tickled about that. But he's a good guy. He's a good character. So that's fine. But I have been more careful subsequently to try and hide those details of people around me. If I really don't like someone, then I include them in the story, but I really, really hide those characteristics very well so that I can get my revenge, but they're never going to figure out who they are. So it's mostly my colleagues that are looking out for themselves in the pages of the book, and maybe not knowing whether they're there or not is not such a bad thing.
I wanted to ask, you know, the state medical world in South Africa is so dysfunctional that it's something that many of us would rather just not look at, especially those of us in the middle class. You know, we know it's there, we know it's terrible, we know all these awful things are going on, but we'd rather not look at it. And when it comes to setting a novel or even several novels in that world, was there any, from the publishers, was there any sense that this is something that's so unpleasant that we don't want novels set in it? Because I know that how your books have actually hit is that they've been incredibly popular and people have been attracted to them and have been reading them in numbers. So they've been very successful. But was there that disjuncture between an expectation of, oh, nobody wants to look at that, but then, oh, yes, people actually do want to look at that?
The only pushback against any kind of medical setting actually came from overseas when I had been putting the Double-Edged and also Single-Minded manuscripts out to agents in the UK. But the pushback then was that, oh, it was around the time of lockdown and just after COVID. No one is interested in medical stories right now, which you're fine. But no pushback in South Africa. No one saying that, well, this is too sensitive to talk about. I think it's a really important topic to talk about, to throw some light on the state of state healthcare in this country. And I think people are always interested in a bit of a look behind the scenes. So as you say, in our middle class world, we maybe don't get exposed to it. Most people, even those that use the state facilities, might not get exposed to, say, what it's like to give birth to a baby in a government facility and how awful that can be. I don't want to scare people, obviously, but I think it's important for people to know that there are two sides to this very polarized health equation, health situation in the country. And yeah, as I said, I think people enjoy to have that little look behind the scenes. Aren't we all curious about what goes on behind closed doors? What happens beyond the point where it says authorized personnel only? And that I think that's what I try. Well, that is what I try and do in my books. Open those doors into a theater environment and say, okay, this is what's happening now behind the scenes. Yeah.
I want to ask you about motherhood and writing, because I have found since having children, it's changed what I can read and it's changed what I can write. I cannot read any books where the child goes missing, for example, which cuts out a lot of thrillers for me. How do you feel motherhood has affected your writing, or has it?
I only started writing after I had children that were older. I think I might have been a little bit more callous to those kind of issues if I'd been writing before I had children. As I said in the acknowledgements in Three Echoes, having children changes you. I mean, it really makes your heart vulnerable to all sorts of pain, and not just your own pain, but other people's pain. So to hear about terrible things happening to children or children going missing, it really tears you apart. So, yeah, I'm like you. There's certain things that I don't want to touch. There's certain topics that I don't want to go close to. Or if I do, I'm going to approach it in a very specific way to protect my own emotions, and in so doing, protect the reader's emotions too. But there are also topics that we do need to discuss, like the number of children that go missing in South Africa. It's both. I'm very sensitive to that, but it's such a prevalent problem in this country, missing children or femicide, that we can't avoid it. You know, if you're writing thrillers set in South Africa, women being killed, children going missing, those topics are going to come up, right? So how do we avoid it? We just have to deal with it with sensitivity. And dealing with violence on the page, it's not easy. In part, I suppose, I'm sensitized to blood and gore to a degree. But on the other hand, I've seen it in such stark reality in the government hospital settings that I'm never going to approach violence with a heavy hand. I'm always going to be very careful about depicting it with care and sensitivity and the victim in mind, and never just using violence for violence sake. If I'm writing about it, it has to have a place in the novel. I'm not going to just kill off people because, you know, let's add to the body count. There always has to be some kind of reason behind it. Even though there's not a reason behind it often in real life, I do try and approach violence with as much sensitivity as I can.
And speaking of protecting yourself, you work in your day job in a setting which I can imagine can become quite upsetting. And then you're also writing about these things, these topics that are really difficult to grapple with. How do you protect your own mental health through all this? Do you have any tips for writers who are writing about difficult things, how they can safeguard their own mental health?
You know, I don't know about you, but I think a lot of us that write, we are observers by nature. And perhaps it's the medic in me, it's the medical training, where you are able to divorce yourself from what's happening in front of you, where you have to maintain a bit of a clinical distance. But I can do that. I can be the observer at the same time as being thoroughly involved in the case on the table, for example. And being that observer is such a psychologically, I think, healthy place to be. I've said it in a couple of talks with kids when we're talking about why I write, is that it's okay to be the person on the outside looking in. You don't always need to be in the throng. You can be quiet and you can observe. And writing about it then gives you a way to exorcise those demons, right? Writing about it then gives you a way to process it. So if anything horrible is happening to you personally, as a writer, you can think, oh, that's awful, but I'm going to put it on the page. Or that person has been a real to me, but you know what? I'm going to make them the next villain in my book. So what a great superpower to have. In terms of work, because I'm working now as a surgical assistant and in a private hospital, there's not too much gore that comes along. But for example, last year I was working for the very first time ever. I was working with I was working for the first time with a surgeon that I just didn't trust his judgment. And that's become a manuscript for me. So it's always, you know, taking this as something to feed the creativity and get it on the page to make sense of it. Isn't that why we write sometimes, is to get these dark emotions out of you and onto the page? And then they're so much easier to deal with. And then you can close the book and put it away. And that's why we like to read horror as well, is because you can feel those things, but then you can close the book and put it away. And you can, there's a little bit of catharsis in life then to get those emotions out of you and like, whew, okay, it was just a story. And then you can move on. Yeah.
That leads actually to my new obsession, which is when do you get ideas and how do the ideas come? So do you, in the middle, you're in this, is it that you're in the surgery and you're not trusting his judgment and you suddenly think, oh, this is a book? Or is it, Fiona and I had a discussion about this before the podcast, for us it's both walking and I think more for me showering and bathing. When is it that those ideas come to you?
So definitely ideas for scenes hit me when I'm working at the hospital and solutions for problems. But for the most part, I do concentrate on the work that's there. So these ideas for the medical scenarios often come as well from the stories that people share. Once I was published, I thought, okay, now this is going to be an indication. When I'm sitting in the doctor's tea room, because there's always time during between surgeries, right? When I'm sitting in the doctor's tea room and I have my laptop open, that's going to be a signal to people that she's working, do not disturb. But the opposite is true. The question now is, oh, you're working on another book. So, and then, you know, then the conversations start. You should write about this or you should write about that. Do you know that... Fact is often stranger than fiction. Just this past a couple of weeks in Durban, one of the local doctors was shot at. Now, if I hadn't been listening in the surgical tea room as to what everyone was speculating about why he was shot at, I wouldn't have fodder for yet another scene in a particular book. So the ideas are everywhere, especially because I'm working in medicine and my novels have this medical focus. But yeah, they come whenever. They do come when I'm running. They do come when I'm cooking or working. And you just have to pluck them out the air and quickly write them down. I've started now WhatsApping myself because that's a great way. You know, you can WhatsApp yourself. That's a great way to just get a quick idea down because they're in and out, right? You know, you're busy with something and that great idea comes, a great solution to a problem, and if you don't write it down, it's gone. So,
do you understand myself? Your notes when you read them back? Because no, I don't.
Not always, especially if it's, you know, just like a few key words, and you're like, what? Who wrote this, and what was I trying to get at? Yeah, and isn't that? I mean, I found that with entire manuscripts, I was like, well, what was I writing here? Who was this person that wrote this nonsense? And then you've got to try and make sense of it. The beloved first review of the first draft. But yes, so ideas come whenever and you've just got to pluck them out the air and be grateful.
Marina, you've talked about submitting your work to overseas agents. Now, since you've been published in South Africa and the books are doing well, have there been any nibbles? And when you are writing, do you keep that overseas audience in mind? I've seen some sort of explanations in your work of maybe, you know, what a hardy-dar is or some local terminology or something like that where I've thought, oh, okay, that's maybe slightly geared more towards the overseas audience. Do you keep that in mind while you're writing?
I do, because the dream is still to publish overseas. I would obviously love a wider market, wouldn't we all? But I haven't put myself out there again with international agents because I've just been too busy with everything else. And it takes a lot of energy, right, to put yourself forward. And then when you get those rejections back, it kind of knocks the wind out of your sails for a little while. And I don't want to be concentrating on that. I want to be concentrating on the next manuscript or the next edit or whatever it is. So I do feel that I'm probably going to try again. I'm going to, but also with the 3-book deal, these 4 books locked in locally, those, my international rights belong to my publisher here. So it's up to them to get it out into the international market. The manuscripts that I have sitting with me that aren't yet signed, I might put those out into the world. But I thought that was going to be 2025's problem, but at this point it's probably going to be 2026's project. I would love to have a wider audience. I'd love to get into the UK market simply because I think that the UK market is probably the more open to a South African story than perhaps the US is. And wouldn't it be nice to see your books featuring elsewhere in the world? And I think it would be great for them to see a bit of the South African story. So yes, that is always in mind when I am writing. And I had to pull back as well because I did think that double-edged maybe would be for the international market, and you use phrases there that would be acceptable in, you know, a sofa instead of a couch. And then the editor reined me in and said, no, in South Africa we say couch. We don't say, you know, we say the boot. It's not the, what do the Americans say?
Trunk.
Yeah, they don't say trunk. So yes, let's keep it South African. And I was very glad to get my books into the South African market. I mean, let's not look beyond that. I'm very glad to have my very South African novels published in South Africa. That was great.
Okay. So we always like to ask our guests what they have been reading or listening to or watching lately that's made an impression on them.
Reading. Oh, I've recently finished Wild Dark Shore by Charlotte McConaughey. It's making waves at the moment in the fiction scene. It's been billed as a thriller, and I don't think that talking about how a book should be labeled, I don't think that really pays it, it really does it for the book, because it's not quite a thriller until maybe the last few chapters, but definitely worthwhile reading. Beautiful descriptions, and the island setting is amazing. I must say, I'm a sucker for a good setting, and the books that stand out in my mind often have these remote locations or very interesting settings. So Wild Dark Shore by Charlotte McConaughey. But I'm busy with Frederick Buckman's trilogy, the Beartown trilogy. I'm on the second book, and he writes so beautifully, and he has such insights into humanity, but it's quite taxing emotionally, so I have to read a bit and then put it aside and then come back. But Frederick Buckman, really one of my favorite authors. Watching, my family is sports mad, and so we often have something on in the background. Live sport I do not enjoy watching. They do, but we found a happy compromise in watching the Tour de France Unchained documentary on Netflix, which I've never been a Tour de France fan except to watch it for the scenery, right? Beautiful French countryside, but really enjoying this Tour de France Unchained documentary because once again, it's a look behind the scenes and you're starting to see the people. And I must say, every episode is a little lesson in storytelling. So it, you follow a particular character or a particular team in an episode, and they're always showing you the rivalries between this team and that team, and there's the underdog, and it's just a lovely little story arc in one episode. So I thoroughly recommend that even to the non-sports lovers. I prefer listening to podcasts. The ones with writing in mind, you might have heard of a couple of them. The Hidden Lives of Writers is one. The Writer Files, Writer's Routine, anything to do with writing, I'm there. I love hearing other authors' stories and about other authors' processes. And then another favorite is How to Fail with Elizabeth Day. Really great podcast, and it just puts that pursuit of perfection into perspective, which is what I need as a perfectionist. And particularly her episodes with authors, I'm trying to think now, Margaret Atwood, Richard Osman, Salman Rushdie. Those are great episodes for me, but her whole podcast is lovely, and I'd recommend that as well. Yeah, so that's where I am.
Well, those are some great recommendations. Thank you. And we hope that everyone checks out Three Echoes, which is recently on the shelves, published by Quella Books, and also your backlist, Double-Edged and Single-Minded. They're all still out there. They're still in print. And we're very much looking forward to the fourth book set in that fictional world. And I'm very, very intrigued by the fifth book, which is 20,000 words in. So good luck with all of that. And thank you so much for your time. Gail, was Marina our first ever medical doctor? I think she might have been.
I think she might have been. I don't want to 100% swear because we know that my memory doesn't really work very well, but I think she was.
Yes, I think so. And such interesting stuff, wasn't it?
Very interesting. And so interesting, the idea of a career that feeds into writing so directly. I mean, I'm a lawyer, so I suppose it should feed into my writing more directly, but I don't feel like it really does. But Marina really draws on what she knows for her writing.
Yes, yes. And she's the expert in this field. Yeah. And that just gives you this feeling of trust that you're in these trustworthy hands when you're reading her books.
Yeah, absolutely. And I liked that anecdote you told about the tendons, although yeah. Then I started picturing tendons, and I don't really know what a tendon looks like in real life, so I wasn't sure what I was picturing. Fiona, what did you take out of it specifically?
So I was so interested in what she said about those doors in hospitals that say authorized personnel only.
Okay, yes.
And as patients, we see them. And there's not even a crack. You can't even peek behind that door. You don't know what's going on there. And if you are on the other side of that door as a patient, you're likely unconscious.
Yes.
So that doesn't help either. But the idea of taking us behind that door and showing us that peek behind the curtain, something we don't normally see, and getting a real horse's mouth version of what goes on behind that white door. I thought that was so interesting and something that we as writers can tap into. Like if we have any specialized knowledge of any situation, we can draw on that to take the reader with us, even if it's just, you know, what's going on behind the bedroom door in a kind of domestic situation.
Well, I was about to say maybe all writing, maybe all fiction is taking us behind a door of some sorts.
Yes.
It might not be as clear as a no authorized personnel door, but no unauthorized personnel door. But all fiction in a way takes us behind a door that we haven't been behind or might not have thought to go behind.
Even just what somebody's thinking, you know,
yes.
We know what they're saying, we know how they're acting, but we don't know what's going on in their mind.
Thank God.
A lot of the time, yes. But fiction gives us a peek into that.
That's true.
And what did you get?
So for me, what was really interesting is I think, and again, let's keep my terrible memory in mind, but I think that Marina is the writer we've interviewed who comes closest to having exactly my process, with one small difference. She writes 1,000 words a day and I write 500 words a day. But I think she has she's in a similar life phase to me. She has children the same age. She has a full-time job. She has the challenges I have of balancing. And what she said about you find time to get it done. You write the words you have to write. It felt very comforting to me that somebody is doing it like I do it, and therefore I'm not doing it wrong.
Yes.
Because, you know, there are so many different ways of doing this, and everyone does do it slightly differently. And sometimes I do get anxious that I'm doing it wrong.
So
I found Marina extremely comforting that I'm doing it like somebody else. There's one person in the world who's doing it like me, so I'm okay.
Well, if any of our listeners have their own special way of doing things, please let us know what it is. And we hope that everyone checks out the books by Marina Auer, published by Quella Books. They're on the shelves right now. They are, I can tell you from personal experience, excellent reads, highly recommended. And if you have read anything by Marina and want to give us your feedback, please get in touch. We are on all social media across the board.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.